John, welcome to Lunar Crush Live. Where are you in the world and what's it like there today?
Well, I'm in Denver, naturally, and it is a little cold today. We had a snowstorm roll through, but it's all right. They always say if you don't like the weather in Denver, just wait, it'll be fine.
I want to learn a little bit about you first here. How did you kind of discover what crypto in general, how did you come across, the industry? What was your first, welcome to crypto story?
In a previous life, I was building HR tech systems and startups just in kind of regular world normie land. My experience is like there's this like repeating sort of like flashing sign, like pay attention to me, but like you don't pay attention to it. You're just like, yeah, whatever. Like I'm busy doing other stuff. So I had many, many people talking to me about Bitcoin in like 2012, and I just pretty much ignored it. And then I was at a random technology conference for executives in Southern California, January 2014. And I met this interesting Russian dude, entrepreneur. His name is Dmitry Buterin. Little did I know that his son, Vitalik, was inventing Ethereum. And he and I struck up a friendship, actually, and we stayed in touch on social media. So, like, I was seeing all of the, white paper about Ethereum and like all this. And I had no idea what it was. Like, I didn't get it. It took me probably 2 years to really get the change, but it just kept coming at me. Like I just couldn't get away from it. It was, between meeting Dima and then like other things that just kind of happened from different angles, it just kept coming at me. And then eventually I started paying attention to it and like, okay, so what is this in the next generation smart contract platform? Like, what the hell is that? Like I And I would always approach technology thinking about it as like efficiency. If you look at how corporations use technology, they use it for efficiency and streamlining and automation. And so I was approaching it that way. But what I didn't understand was like it's actually a social shift. It's like a paradigm shift in how we issue money, monetary policy, economic games, like everything. It was like one of those moments that you couldn't unsee. It was just like, oh, mid 2016 when that finally happened for me. And then I just went all in and I've been in full time in crypto since then. So I sold all of my old interests and I exited my businesses. I pivoted to startup and raised new capital. And then by the time 2017 rolled around, I was completely out of everything else that I had built for almost 15 years. And I haven't looked back. So crazy story, but like it sort of put on its tractor beam and it just wouldn't let me go.
We'll say that's the first time I've asked that question. The bug that got them was Vitalik's
Right? I mean, you can't make this stuff up. I mean, like we weren't there to talk about crypto either. It was like other stuff. It was like just technology entrepreneurship.
I like what you said about, once you fully kind of grasped it, you're like, there's no going back.
You
And
can't
it
unsee it. It's hard for me to articulate how powerful that experience was for me because in my professional career, there's maybe been like a couple of like really formative like aha moments where you're just like, oh shit. And that's like one of them. And it's just like, I can't imagine what my life would be like without it. Everything that I do now is because of that.
What do you think the one piece or like a couple of the pieces were that really flipped this switch for you? For me, if someone is pushing back on what's happening in the industry, it actually means they don't understand how the blockchain works. They don't understand decentralization. They don't, it's like sensor resistant. There's like a couple of things in there that that just really kind of flip and you say, wow, there's going to be an entire ecosystem that's built in just a slightly different way that is going to change everything. And so it's like once you realize that and your mind starts going crazy on like the amount of things that you can build and other people are going to build and oh, how it's going to disrupt this thing. That's when like you catch that, where I feel like people that are still pushing back don't they actually don't understand that piece. So was that
Well,
kind of it for you? Like,
I think most of it's people have implicit confirmation bias and they operate from what they know. And what they know, like me, about technology is that it's automation, it's simplification, it's efficiency. The concept of decentralization, it's like, well, what does that mean exactly? Like, how does that help people? It's not that accessible. It's almost theological, right? Where it's like, well, it's better so people don't exploit individuals, because, you know, third-party intermediaries can often be extractive and exploitive of their positions of power. What? Like, what are you talking about? Like, I'm just used to banks doing what they do, right? I'm just used to these things. And it's like, I haven't thought much about, like, what would a more benevolent system look like? I think it's an evolutionary process. I think I have a saying that you can't educate your way to mass adoption. I think that there is going to be a large amount of people. In fact, probably most people are only going to use this tech once it's cheaper, better, faster. And it might not even be cheaper. It might be, hey, I can start earning money by using these things. Like next generation earning income and income opportunities in Web3 environments is like a whole new emerging paradigm, for example. If average people can start making money by playing games or contributing to ecosystems, or, you know, with really low barriers to entry and high exit fluidity, why aren't people going to do it, right? Of course they're going to do it. But we're just not there yet. But I don't think philosophically, I think most people, you know, they're comfortable in their lives. Most people don't care about the concept of decentralization, I found. They don't even know how to describe it. Like, so yeah. How,
I mean, it's hard to even describe for some of us that have been in the industry for years. Someone's like, oh, can you just explain this very simple concept? And you're like, ooh, you got to like kind of come back out of it.
In lay terms, right? Like, yeah. No, 100%. So, you know, and this is why I harp on things like user experience and UI, private key management abstraction. Like, how do we make these tools easier for people to participate in them without compromising the sovereignty of the tech, right? Because at some point, you know, custodial wallets are just next generation banks, right? Like, they're not, I mean, if you have an intermediary third party who's managing your private key, and it's the same thing as a bank, what they do right now. If we don't really honor the concepts with better tool sets, we're never going to get there. But we will. I mean, I think the genie's out of the bottle. It's a function of time, of when, not if, and what the next vector of mass adoption is going to be, like in terms of like use cases. I don't know. It's going to be interesting.
Well, I want to hear a little bit about Opolis and what you guys are building.
Yeah, so Opolis is really a culmination of my life's work when it comes to like my profession, call it, or my learnings. You know, I've been in HR tech and employment systems for 20 years, so I've seen a lot. I mean, I've employed W2'd 40,000 people over about 15 years of that. You got a front row seat to compliance and paying taxes and health benefits and like all sorts of stuff, just checking the boxes of employment things that you do. One of the things that stood out to me even back in, I mean, I started talking about this in 2005, the concept of democratized employment, because what I was noticing, the power dynamic between employer and employee was incredibly subjugated, incredibly paternalistic, and incredibly controlling, and in some cases, very exploitive. So for me, I was like, you know, wouldn't people be more productive if you had a more mutualistic relationship with them and you treated them better and gave them, you know, the ability to kind of opt into things that were of importance to them? And like, nobody was talking about this stuff back then. I mean, this is almost 20 years ago, you know, when I was talking about this. I put my marker down. I was like, you know, I'm going to democratize employment. But it took a lot of experiments and iterations to like figure out what the hell that meant, and failures, like things that didn't scale, startups that we kind of toyed around with that didn't work or sort of moderately worked, but just would never scale to like some sort of mass infrastructure. So what Opolis is a culmination of all this work, and it's a cooperative platform. You could call it an employment DAO that provides members of the community employment and related services. So instead of a corporation providing me employment as a permissioned activity, where like, okay, well, you subjugate me your time and attention, I'll pay you 80 grand a year and I'll give you healthcare benefits. But if you don't do as I ask you to do, then you're going to lose your healthcare. How else are you going to get this stuff? So what we've done is we've basically made it so that individuals, solopreneurs, anybody who's working independently can access employment, replicate it down to the T, so they can get all the compliance and pay stubs and income verification, health benefits, group health care, retirement plans, everything that you would typically get with a traditional employment corporate mechanism, but you can do it for yourself.
Interesting.
So we call it self-sovereign employment. So we talk about self-sovereign data, we talk about self-sovereign identity. But to me, commercially, the thing that we need to unlock to give people real choice and freedom around their commercial activities is the compliance. Like, you can't have yourself subjugated to some corporate structure. You don't own it. They do. What we're doing is we're just giving people the keys to their employment and saying, well, you own it now. We're also the pioneers of the digital co-op movement. So when you see DAOs that are wrapped in the legal framework of a co-op, we started that trend. And that's actually happening quite a bit now.
You know, if you're an entrepreneur, you want to be an entrepreneur and you want to start a business, and, you know, all the math and the studies say that actually entrepreneurs who are a little bit older have a higher probability of being successful, you know, if they get out there and they do it, but they're also kind of overburdened with, you know, maybe you have a family of five, you know, and you've got benefits that are out there, and people sometimes will stay at these jobs, or maybe they won't even retire because they're like, man, now I got to go pay all these benefits. Right. And it's like, think about how many entrepreneurs we're probably missing, and the innovation that we're missing simply because we won't take care of people.
No, well, exactly correct. Or we're just not offering optionality, right? I mean, it's sort of an either or. Like, you can subjugate yourself to a corporate structure and get good healthcare, or you can go on your own and good luck.
You know, I have a relationship with maybe one employer or multiple employers or whoever it is that's out there that's going to pay me for my work. But now I'm not reliant on them for any sort of like retirement option, benefits.
Well, they're also not on the hook for the compliance and all the risk and all that. Like, you're taking all of that away. So if you really get down to the social behaviors and the economic behaviors, the reason why corporations are so controlling of their employees is because it's risky, it's expensive, and they have a lot of compliance risk, and they have a lot of, like, you know, there's a lot of moving parts. So they hire people called HR people to manage that risk. And then the way these HR people set up policies and structures, it's very controlling. It's very rigid. It's about saving money. So if you unbundle that risk and responsibility from the traditional corporate employer, hand it to the individual, but de-risk it through a community structure. Now the formerly known as employer doesn't have all this crazy stuff to manage, but the individual is like, well, I don't want to do this on my own, but they don't have to, because now it's being de-risked through a community structure and it's being done on their behalf. So now the incentives are much more aligned. So you don't have these competing interests or these additional risk and cost on top of, like, these other problematic relational dynamics, right? So you basically streamline it so that the risk sits where it should, which is with the individual, but you're de-risking it at scale with a huge community of folks. And then the behaviors of the traditional employer shift because they no longer have to take responsibility for that.
That HR position is also, it's a very tricky and interesting position at a company too. There's a reason that there's a lot of, like, psychologists or social workers that end up in that. And I always kind of tell people, mm-hmm. I'm like, hey, HR works for the company. You know, you got to remember that. But it seems like
they're not your friends. They're not your advocates. I mean, yeah. I mean, they might, I mean, it's just like any corporate virtue signaling, you know, like, oh yeah, we're here for you and all this. It's like, but you're not really. I mean, you're here to manage risk on behalf of the company. That's your job. And if you've got to make a decision about, like, what's best for what, you're going to not look at my best interest. You're going to look at the company's best interest. They don't work for you.
And so if I'm a contractor and I'm doing work out there, maybe I'm a designer, you know, I'm a developer, I've picked up business. I mean, and especially in our industry, you know, it's global. If I'm a community member, am I kind of paying into the foundation, or am I paying into the community and I get benefits and I can kind of pick and choose the benefits that I want and I'm part of that. Yep. And then I stop paying in. Like, how do you guys kind of structure it where it's like, do you have a couple of months of benefits or whatnot? Do you pay every single month?
You have 1 month. Yeah, you have one. You pay every month. It's just like, you know, if you were to go to any third party payroll company, if you mm-hmm. could, but you can't because you're a solopreneur, but we send invoices twice a month. We'll invoice you for your payroll and your ancillary benefits that you've elected. So you get complete optionality around what you want: healthcare, vision, dental, life insurance, long-term, short-term disability, whatever it might be. Built into your paycheck is also unemployment insurance and workman's comp. So, like, these are all statutorily required things as part of employment. And let's say the bill we send you is $4,500 and, you know, we withhold all the taxes and all the different things that need to get paid. We pay them on your behalf so you don't have to ship money around or do quarterly tax withholdings or any of that crap. And out the back end, you get a paycheck deposited to your bank account, direct deposit, just like you would normally. So your company is paying yourself. We're just using an existing framework in a slightly different way to get people the essentially replicated employment experience down to the paycheck, down to the benefits that I choose. And as long as I continue to pay my bill, I maintain my membership. So the incentive is to stick around and pay my bill because, like, I don't want to lose my healthcare. So it's not just you get healthcare and you don't have to pay for it. Like, no, you have to pay for it, but like, but the game design is well managed.
And so as a, it's the offering for a company. So if, as a company, we could utilize that, but also an individual could pay in on their own.
Well, and so all of our individual members are wrapped in a legal entity. So they're all technically companies, but they're companies of one.
Right.
The people that we do business with are the company, right? They just happen to have a legal entity. And the way that we're using their entity is that they become the only employee of their entity.
Have you had any companies approach you and say, like, hey, I want you guys to just take this all over for us?
Of course. I mean, we've done some pretty big things. So like when MakerDAO shuttered their legal entity, the foundation, you know, MakerDAO went full DAO. They don't have a legal entity anymore. Now, what happens to all those people that were employed by the DAO or by the foundation? Good question, right? Yeah. You no longer have an entity to like house any of these folks. You can't procure healthcare benefits or anything if you don't have an entity. So what do? Well, we helped all of their individual contributors get their entities set up, wrap themselves, and then become Opolis members and essentially become self-sovereign employees. Now they have contracts with the DAO to perform certain services, right? So like if I'm a community person or a software dev or whatever, but that's, you know, their entity doing business with the DAO. But then as the employment goes, they handle it themselves through Opolis, but they don't need permission. And some of them are working for 2, 3, 4 DAOs at a time now. So it's like having 3 or 4 consulting gigs rolling to one entity, but then I have one paycheck because I'm paying myself.
It's really interesting because even as a business operator, I'm thinking there's kind of a cool model here where if I knew based on what salary levels everyone was at, what your cost structure was, and I could build that into an offer saying, hey, everything's operated through something like an Opolis, but here's exactly where these numbers are at. So here's your take home, where your take home is probably going to be at the end of the day, knowing that here's this structure. And then you kind of offload a lot of that operation to someone. And honestly, there's a lot of, especially in startup, there's a lot of people that are super entrepreneur themselves, you know, whether they have another kind of side thing that they're working on. Like, I think that's pretty cool. If someone's that entrepreneurial, it's like,
well, that's going to be the wave of the future. I mean, the typical trajectory of a person's career, like you have one job, all my eggs in one basket, so to speak. So from a risk management standpoint, it's pretty bad planning, right? Because if that company goes out of business or if they lay me off, I'm screwed. I got nothing. So into the future, I don't see any reason why people aren't going to risk manage their work streams because you have choice. You'll have the ability to do that, to choose that and say like, okay, well, I'm going to, instead of contributing just to one project, I'm going to have 2 or 3 things going on. That way, if one of them goes away, I don't have to replace the whole damn thing. And then I maintain more flexibility because I can kind of choose where to put my time. So the social predicates of all of this, the underlying values, are freedom and flexibility. That's what's driving this. That's what people want in today's labor force. The old school structures, though, are designed for safety and security. So we have a competing sort of structural infrastructure. You know, the structural infrastructure is competing with what people really want. And so what we're doing is just saying, okay, well, how do you have your cake and eat it too? And how do you give people the safety and security, but also giving them the freedom and flexibility? And that's what we build.
It's such a departure from, I mean, there's still pensions out there.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, not very many, but like, yeah, there's still some of that where it's like, I mean, how many people do you know that have put in 30 years of work at one company?
My grandfather, that was about, that's
yeah,
a lot.
that 2 generations ago, like nobody's doing that anymore. My mother did that. In the younger generations, you're talking the fluidity is like sub 3 years. It's like, you know, 18 months in some cases. They're bopping around. The labor force statistics are fascinating in Gen Z. You're talking 55% are not working for W-2 jobs. They're working full-time independently. Over half of that cohort, they don't want it. They don't see the safety and security because they're like, it's not real. So why do it?
They're so used to just getting rugged economically. by
or watching their elders get rugged. Yeah. And they're like, why would you want to do that? Like, I'm not doing that. You know, like you can get rugged, but I'm not. Nobody wants to go to the office anymore. Everybody realized they can be just as productive from home. They want freedom and flexibility. They don't care about kombucha. I mean, some of them do, but like, but it's not sticky. It's not advancing the social graph and productivity graph for that social contract. It's actually undermining it. Like all of the entertainment culture that we built into corporate environments has actually undermined productivity.
Yeah, I still feel like I agree with you. We haven't reached a true understanding of what that work from home shift was. You know, I think the early stat was like, it was World War II. You know, there's about, you know, 3% of the workforce was women. And then during World War II, it was over 50%. Mm-hmm. And then after the war went down, but it went down to like 25%. So it was still, or 30%. So it was still a 10x increase. And I feel like the same for work at home where, you know, maybe 5% of the people work at home before, it went to 100% basically. It's going to come back, but it's going to be much higher than it was. I mean, you've got, you know, people that find a new place, they're going to go rent a new spot. You're not thinking as you walk in there, where am I going to work here? Even a couple of years ago, you weren't even thinking, where am I going to work in my house? Right. But now that's a decision that, like, you know, housing hasn't caught up with that. We still haven't figured the best way. My question would be like, what do you think this kind of, I've been trying to nail down, is it, you know, I don't think like coming in on a Wednesday works, or like, you know, if you have a family, you know, you're not going to do a 2-week offsite with everyone and go play ping pong down in like Costa Rica or whatever's going on. Right. So it's like, but I don't necessarily know where the next generation is. As someone that's got and sees so many different companies and people, is there some sort of, you know, can you give us a little bit of the, you know,
I don't think there's a blueprint. I think what organizations need to optimize for is choice. The point being is every person has a little bit different way of being productive. And if you try to engineer a solution that's like one size fits all, like, oh, we're going to have this particular exact structure. We got this home office set up, this thing and this thing and this thing. That's not how people work. So like prescribing some sort of solution is actually the opposite of what I think needs to happen. I think giving people choice. So here's what I think is going to happen. I think one, we're going to move away from, you know, the punch in the clock sort of thing where it's like, you know, between these hours, this is what we're doing. I think we're going to move away from that. And I think we're going to move to a statement of work culture where if I'm hired by an organization to do a job, the important thing is that I do it and that it's well-defined what I need to do and when I need to do it by. But then how I get there, you know, between here and that deadline, it's kind of up to me to figure out how to get it over the finish line. I think that's where we're going, because you can't, if you've got somebody working from their house, you're a fool if you think that you're going to be able to control how they deliver you work product, because they're going to lie to you and they're going to do all sorts of stuff to obfuscate what's really going on. And they're going to give you whatever vision it is that you think you need to get. But the reality is all you really should care about is that they get the job done by a certain time. That's it. You know, as an employer, as somebody who's employed a lot of people, that's all I really care about. So what do I care about? How you get it done? I don't. So I should get out of the business of trying to care about how you get it done and be very clear about what needs to be done and by when. So that's where I think things are going to go, because I think you can't do anything different. Not functionally. I mean, for posterity's sake, you might think you can, but I don't think you really can.
Yeah, you're painting a picture of it. It's requirements. Very, you know, I feel like there's an opportunity for a very clear and concise, like, requirements, right? Like, here's
what statement of work. Like, here's what needs to be done, and here's when it needs to be done by. And, like, how you get there, don't care. It's your responsibility to get it done and to deliver a product that is of high quality. It's excellent, right? So other than that, what does anybody care about?
You shouldn't.
You know, and it's fascinating to me how much work we've put into like caring about how people get stuff done. No, you need to be in the office between 8 and 6 and you got to do this and you got to do that. It's like, you think this is contributing to people's productivity?
Well, with big tech, middle management and managers, it was kind of, I feel like it was seen as the only way that you got paid more money, you know, which in someone's mind, I'm going to provide for my family, I'm going to go make more money, was to whether you had a larger team or you can just kind of work your way up. Right. And it was super competitive, mm-hmm. but it's like, what is that doing for the output of the business? What is that doing for the output of innovation? Right. So it was the incentive systems were all broken. Right. But then you have that many people in one place. All they can think about is, well, we have to redo this org structure or move these teams around or whatever. And now suddenly it's like, oh my God, as an individual contributor, you're like, I've got no idea what I need to do here. Right. And I've got to use a different, I got to log in for a different software to do my time, to do all these things. Mm-hmm. It's like, just tell someone what needs to get done and why. I think the why thing is really important. Why does this need to get done? What are we trying to achieve here? Because maybe your way of doing it, that's the reason that you're hired, is probably better than mine.
Well, it should be. I mean, yeah. Hopefully that's the idea. I mean, anytime I hire somebody, the simple litmus test is if you can, you should be able to do it better than me. And if you can't, then we probably got the wrong person. So, you know, yeah. But I mean, I think what we're basically foreshadowing here is allowing people to express their creative genius in their own ways, however they want to express it to get a particular job done. And how they go about doing it is really their creative license. It's up to them. Like, and that's not really something that we've nurtured in the corporate setting for the past 50 years. You know, we haven't. And, but I don't see another path, because the alternative is workers are just going to opt out.
Yeah. They're not going back. I mean, even before COVID, I was working from home and you'd go for a jog at, you know, because maybe you work in the morning, you know, there's days where I was work super early and by 10 a.m. it's beautiful, it's sunny out, I'm going to go for a jog. Got the sun on my back, I'm feeling great, I'm getting a workout in, go back to work at noon. You can't do that, right? Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking on one of those runs, I was like, as soon as anyone gets out here and does this, they're never going back. Like they would never. Because at the time I was like, I'm never going to go and work exactly the way, you know, I used to drive into Chicago every day for work and it was like middle of winter. I would like, you know, either get 45 to a train,
minutes each way and all hour this and a crap.
Half. Yeah. Yeah. I would get like car sick while driving. I was like, this is like, who does this? And thinking about all the people going back and forth every day for 50 years.
Everybody's like, doing it. This is insane. They're all doing it, but yeah. It's a trade-off calculus. Okay. So why are they doing it? They're willing to trade off because the end outcome, the yield, is much greater than not doing it. So I didn't have a choice, right? I couldn't work from home. I couldn't work in my neighborhood. I couldn't. So arbitraging my time wasn't so easy. So I have to make the commute. And there isn't another path of opportunity, right? So like I can't opt out. So I do it because that's kind of the choice. You know, that's the best right. option. It's like running movies from Blockbuster. Like, yeah, you're going to go do it until Redbox and Netflix are available. But then the minute those are available, like I'm opting out of Blockbuster, right? The same thing is true for work opportunities. Like we just haven't had them. The virtual opportunities are just really beginning. I mean, if you think about what's next, instead of just being able to work remotely, when some guy who spent 10 years in school between undergrad and postgrad, who loves gaming, realizes that there's work to earn NFT-based earning games that you can play that are positive sum new economic models, and he can spend 4 hours a day doing that and make triple the income that he was making in all of his educational activities, you think he's not going to opt out?
Yeah.
You think he's not going to go do that instead? Now, these are just beginning, right? So these new economic models are brand new and no one really knows about them yet. And they're not very mature. So once it matures, you think we're not going to have a mass exodus of people out of the traditional labor force? And they're just like, you know, I don't need your bullshit job. I mean, screw working from home. They're not going to do it at all.
Yeah.
Because they're just going to find a different way to arbitrage their time. Right. So it's all about that calculus of how can I better arbitrage my time, and optionality and choice is going to be abundant when it comes to where to put my time and attention 5-10 years into the future. And corporations that normally had their pick because there weren't other choices are now going to be facing massive labor shortages, and they're going to have to fundamentally change their DNA and how they treat people because they're, you know, it's not just about extracting value from humans now. It's I actually have to stand and do something important, or else no one's going to want to work with me. And because they don't have to.
And the, yeah, it's those people that are going to drive the innovation, and the corporations have to react, or they don't stay competitive. Right?
They're going to be gone. They're going to be extinct because no one's going to want to work with them. You see this already if you actually get under the hood and why Gen Zers are not subjugating themselves to traditional corporate jobs. One of the common themes is they don't align values with these corporations. Like, I don't want to contribute to a company that I don't, you know, I want to contribute to something that's more like bigger purpose, you know, higher purpose. Like, and I just don't think that these corporations care a bunch about people. You think that's going to change? It's going to get worse.
Quarterly earnings.
Right. But, but now they're speaking with their feet because there's choices. The youngest population is just saying, no, thanks.
Yep. And they have optionality that they didn't have.
Exactly. Incredible, even the older generations, like the Xers and millennials, have optionality now, but they're just kind of conditioned in the matrix. Mm-hmm. But more and more of them are opting out. And it's going to, that trend is going to continue. And then as the younger generations come up, it's just going to be the norm. They won't have to opt out. They just won't ever opt in.
And naturally, a lot of the companies in Web3, you had to be built that way anyway. You had to prioritize for being fully remote. You know, you never were thinking, you know, there's people in Singapore, there's people in Portugal, there's people all over the world, and the best talent is could be somewhere else. It's, I think the thing that always blew my mind was, I was like, what is the probability that the best person for this job is within like 6 miles where I'm sitting? Like you're like, there's a very low probability that that's actually the person. I think it's, how do you find those people? I think there's obviously like time zone differences and some certain things there, but if you can really optimize for like a 24-hour work schedule in some way where someone's working the other side of the world when you're not, and there's a lot of like, there's a high level of trust and there's like a speed of trust, I feel like it's, you're unstoppable.
Yeah, just the agility that this next generation of, like, I mean, think about using Opolis as an underpin protocol to outsource essentially the traditional employment mechanism, but give the employees the control. So I maintain maximum flexibility. I can access people globally. I can stay completely nimble and flexible based on what my needs are to execute projects. And I can do this. I can scale up and scale down with the snap of the fingers, but I'm not screwing anybody doing it. Like, yeah. I'm giving people their optionality and control of the things they need control of, but then I can control my business activities and decisions much more fluidly. So like it is, I mean, I call this, you know, the advent of more egalitarian employment systems and more mutualistic employment systems, because if you look at the social dynamic today, it's all paternalistic and we're moving to mutualistic. And that's really the simple sort of shift. It's from here to here. And we just have to build the frameworks around it to enable it and then let it mature, water it and feed it and watch it grow, because people are going to choose this path. It's absolutely inevitable that they're going to choose it, because it's in alignment with their incentives to choose it. They just haven't had the opportunity to choose it previously.
Yes. It's that same feeling that I had on that run. Like, once someone feels it just a little bit, they're never going back.
You can't go back.
Yeah. But by the way, you remember, you said Blockbuster, talk about wasting time. Do you remember like having to go put the tapes back in the little slot?
Oh yeah. Like, well, and then getting the fine for not rewinding and doing all this crap. And it's like,
think about the amount of time we all wait. Like, people are like, oh, innovation. It's like, well, there's an innovation right there that that's insanity. I want to just switch gears real quick. So let's talk about ETH Denver. It's coming up here. Mm-hmm. Executive steward of ETH Denver. What does that entail?
So Web3 is the emergence of new economic systems that are more systemically benevolent. So, you know, with every project comes some need for management, oversight, leadership, but we don't like the traditional taxonomy of like CEO or any of that stuff, because it has a sort of hierarchical implications and like power implications and importance implications. And like, Eat Denver is the world's largest live action Web3 experience. And it's not really a conference. It's a community innovation festival. And so, you know, to be the CEO of that seems kind of dumb. And so like we use the term steward to describe our relationship to the project and the community more so in the terms of like, hey, it's like I've got my hand on the back of the bike. You know, like my job is to make sure that we stay up and that we stay on course and that, you know, as we mature as a community, you know, I can start letting go of the back of the bike, right? But I'm not here to do anything more than steward and stay on track. It's not, you know, I have ultimately the responsibility to set the tone, cast a vision, and set the course. But then, you know, over time, once that matures, you're not going to need me to do that. I'm just part of the community like everybody else. Now, executing an event of this size takes a certain amount of centralized organizational effort. But again, to maintain the sort of tone of benevolence, we use the concept of steward for all of our contributors. So when we say it, you know, hey, I'm the steward of sponsorships, or I'm the steward of, you know, food and beverage, or I'm the steward of content, like it sort of casts a tone of yeah, like, I'm here. Approach. Yeah, we prefer it. And you actually see it quite a bit now in Web3. Like we were the first ones to do this back in, I was doing this in 2017. Actually, I was referring to myself as a steward even in a previous startup before I got into Web3. But that's a different story. But yeah, we prefer it. It also kind of, you know, checks your head sometimes because like, you know, remind yourself, I'm a steward, you know, I'm here to protect the ethos of what we're doing, not to promote my own self-interest. My self-interest is a byproduct of what's good for the community. So we've aligned incentives around the individual and the community, and then executing at scale is really where we all win.
And no, I love the approach. Like, I think it's beautiful. I think, you know, cause that's ultimately what you're trying to do is just kind of keep the train going down.
The train's running on time.
Yeah.
And that's actually, I use that description a lot. What's your job? My job is to make sure the trains run on time. Like to make sure that people show up to do what they need to do when they need to do it. And then we deliver excellence and benevolence to our community at scale. And we deliver these sort of futuristic experiences of what the Web3 world could be. That's really what 8th Denver is all about. That's why there's so much FOMO about it, because it's not a conference. It's the only event in the world whose main event is the build-a-thon. Everybody else does the hackathons as like an afterthought. Oh yeah, there's a hackathon this weekend. No. Ours is the main event. We don't have a blockchain week. We have a Biddle week.
Yeah.
So Biddle week was, Biddle the meme. We created that meme in 2018. So the whole, you know, Biddle culture of Ethereum and all that came from Eat Denver.
Yeah. The traditional conference is so played out.
Ugh.
Right. It's just, you know, you've got four or five people up there kind of pontificating about, you know, maybe from their small corner of the world, the way that they see something, and it ends up being, you know, 60% marketing for them, and someone paid someone to do what. And it's
I call it fart smelling. So there's a South Park episode where, like, you know, the smug San Francisco folks, and, yeah, you know, I don't know if you saw that one. It's hilarious.
I did.
Yeah. But like, that's what it kind of reminds me of. You know, you get these quote thought leaders, these self-described, you know, futurists and all this. And it's like, the level of self-importance is pretty staggering. Now I know why they do it. I mean, it's marketing, and certainly I've done my fair share of, you know, talking and even egregious shilling to a certain extent, but you're right, as a general format, it's very tired. And like, you know, what am I going to do? Spend $1,500 on a ticket to go sit in the audience and listen to that? Like, ugh, it's terrible. Like I would rather like do the hallway track and just sit around and talk to people I know or meet new people or whatever.
That's what most people do.
They'll
bring a team and they'll be like, hey, are you going to go to the conference? They're like, well, no, we just got a house and like, we'll just kind of hang out. We'll do a party here.
Side events. 100%. Yeah. So the irony is, though, Eat Denver is the opposite. So when people come to Eat Denver, it's like a big tent and a blank canvas. Come express your creativity in a way that's meaningful for you. And it's free to come. We don't charge for tickets. And like, I mean, the crazy stuff that people come and do, and this, the authenticity by which people do it, it's beautiful. And like the culture, the vibe that we've created is unlike anything else I've seen anywhere. And I've been around all over the world to these things. And like, it's literally the only one that's been able to do it at scale. So what's the secret recipe? Well, it's a lot of factors that go into it, but like the fact that we don't charge for tickets, that we remove all economic barriers, as many as possible, geographic, economic, proximity barriers. Like, we remove everything. We give people free unabated access to education. We educate our speakers on being educational, not shilly. Like, we don't allow certain type of content because like, we just don't want it.
Yeah.
You know, be educational, teach people something. You're smart. You know, don't just make it like a personal shill fest, but like teach something. But just those little cues, the little things make a big difference, especially at scale. And then we have 170 global sponsors, but none of them are corporate. They're all emergent projects. You know, these are technologies and protocols and communities that believe in the Eat Denver vibe.
And how long have you guys been doing this now with Eat
Denver? This is our sixth year.
And each year when you do it, you know, I'm sure there's a moment where it gets maybe a little quiet, or you get off stage, or you go in a corner, you do something. Is there a moment each year where you've just kind of had a little smile? Maybe you're like 85% of the way through and everything's gone really well. The train's almost well, there.
Every year there's always like a moment that I would call like the mic drop moment, right? Yeah. So it depends on the year. But like one of them, for example, was we wrote a book called B is for Bufficorn, and it's a children's book, right? So A is for attestation, B is for Bufficorn, C is for consensus, D is for decentralization. There's all illustrations, each page is really nice. But we had two sitting governors, so the governor of Wyoming and the governor of Colorado, Vitalik Buterin and a Bufficorn, reading this book to a bunch of kids on live stream. Okay, now you can't get sitting governors to come to these things, much less read a kid's book, you know, sitting on a stage with the kids, you know, on the ground, reading the book with Vitalik. It's like, come on, man. Like, how do we, you know, that's like, it's like tattooed in my mind, you know, is like mic drop, dude. Like, so, and that almost didn't happen. It was organic. Like, I mean, trying to get the governor's schedules to align and all this, it just worked out. And it's beautiful. It's great. So we have those moments every year. So like, that's the kind of stuff that keeps me coming back. You know, throughout the year, I'll get hundreds of notes from people that are like, Eat Denver changed my life, and here's how. I got this job, I got funding, I started a project, I found this co-founder, I did this, I did that, whatever it is, like hundreds of these. And like, we don't, I mean, what do we get out of it? Like that, that's, it's amazing what kind of, like I said, it's a big tent and a blank canvas. It's a space and a place for people to come and express themselves creatively in ways that otherwise they wouldn't have the opportunity. And then what comes out of it is magic, because you just literally don't know what people are going to do. And sometimes it'll surprise the hell out of you, because you're just like, holy shit, they created what? I mean, we've had Pool Together and PoApp and One Inch and a whole bunch of projects on our finalist stage over the years. And these are, when they were on our stage, they were nobody.
Yeah.
You know? And now they're like
big projects.
Huge projects.
Yeah.
And that's just the tip of the iceberg. That's just the notable ones. But there's like a whole iceberg of like creativity that has been expressed, that continues to be expressed, which is why if you go on Twitter and you look around like at the FOMO, it's not, we don't pay anybody. We don't pay anybody to shill that we have millions of mentions, millions of views and impressions on their content. Everyone's co-branding everything ETH Denver because everybody wants to be affiliated with the brand, but we get all this free marketing. You literally couldn't pay for it.
Yeah, you can't. And you're stewarding the experience. I mean, yeah. And there's like you're embodying the ethos of what this industry is and this space and this innovation and whatever you want to call it, this culture. And
I think that's a good point though, because like conferences as a DNA don't. Like the typical conference format is not the future of Web3. It's actually very OG, old school, content format.
Yeah. I bet a lot of the conferences that you see, whether it's from companies or whatnot, the conference might be more profitable than their actual product. Right.
Oh, guaranteed.
Like they're a software company. It's like, well, how much you make on the software? It's like, well, we make $1 million, but we make $5 off the conference. It's like, okay.
Yeah.
Is that a unicorn business? I don't know. It sounds like you're a conference. But I do love like when you go to a conference like yours where, you can also look around and there's people that are there and you're like, oh, do you work in the industry? Or do you own NFTs? And some people are like, no, I just think everyone's like really awesome here. Like I saw this, there was this concert going on, or, you see that with like an insurance conference. People aren't just showing up. That mm-hmm. have nothing to do with the insurance business that's going on. But you see that
it's a social paradigm. Oh, yeah. It's a social paradigm. And sometimes they don't really know what's attracting them. They're not like, they wouldn't even be able to describe it to you. But they're there because they're curious and they're intrigued. And it's sort of like pulling on a string that's in them. There's like this creativity or some sort of like, futuristic curiosity that mm-hmm. they get sucked into, and then before you know it, they're down the rabbit hole, and next thing you know, they're building a project and they're doing something else, and it's just like, but you would never get these people to come if it was $1,500 a ticket.
Same thing for me. I was a gamer, I loved playing. When I found crypto, suddenly I walked into a room and I was like, these are all the kids that I used to play games with. Like these are the smart kids, these are the fun, this is exciting. And some of those people might not be as socially apt as the rest of the world per se, but if you understand what's going on just a little bit and you're in and you're curious and you're humble about it, you're going to open the door to something amazing. And I think that's where the rest of the world's kind of potentially finding their way in. It is a little unfortunate. I feel like in the last year, the blowups that happened are these companies that really don't represent what you represent or what the industry really represents in any way whatsoever. No. They were trying to rebuild some weird mansion of traditional finance.
The co-opting of crypto, right? So like centralized finance is not the future of Web3. They're just managing people's money in a different asset, as is proven through the history of mankind. How many times have we breached fiduciary responsibilities in that model? All the time, from Bernie Madoff to whatever. We've greed and personal ambition and all sorts of like human flaws rear their heads, because that's the point of smart contracts and decentralized finance, because you don't have to deal with the human nature of things. You can deal with code, right? So I think it just underscores the importance of where the decentralized movement's going. And it also reemphasizes the reason to hold your own keys and to manage your own stuff. Like it has nothing to do with Web3, but we still have to deal with the stigma because most people don't understand any of that. So we'll get through it though. It'll be fine.
We did a full hour here, man. Where can people find you?
Well, Twitter is pretty much the only place I hang out anymore. So it's at PallerJohn, PallerJohn. If anybody watching this is debating whether or not to come out to ETH Denver, I can only say it like this. There's no explaining it. There's only experiencing it. And it's unlike anything you've ever seen in your life. And it's unlike anything you'll ever see in the future of your life. So if there's ever a time to come, and if you really want to get a glimpse into the future of what things might be like, come and check it out, because it's unexplainable, and it will literally change your perspective on everything.